The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian's Tech Weekly for the week of April 19th. I'm Alex Kratosky. Now, the election race is accelerating towards the May finishing line. And on this week's podcast, we have the latest from the candidates who are making digital their primary campaign issue. Twitter has been making big announcements. We dissect how the updates will affect the service. Guardian Games columnist Keith Stewart reports on Alan Wake, widely anticipated to be one of the top five computer games of the year.
Alan!
Alice! My wife is missing. They took her.
I found many pages. We can't talk here. Come meet me in another one.
Alan Wake for the Xbox. And activist and journalist Heather Brooke tells me how she used technology and the Freedom of Information Act to expose MPs' expenses. Joining me in the studio are Guardian Technology editor Charles Arthur and games columnist Keith Stewart. Welcome, Charles and Keith. Now, Charles, the big news this week has been the Icelandic volcano that has effectively cut the UK off from the rest of the world. My family are still in the country.
Rest of the world isolated.
Yeah, that's right. Rest of the world isolated. We are the center of the universe. Have you experienced any of the fallout?
Well, it hasn't really affected me personally, though I have to say that in 1979, while I was on holiday in Barbados, Soufriere, which is on an island to the west of Barbados, went off and dumped a whole lot of volcanic ash all over the island, and a lot of very unwise people then tried to wash it off their cars. Scritchy scratch, all the cars are completely, you know, made a lot of the people, you know, who did car finishing very happy because they got a lot of business.
Keith, this week we're talking to independent candidates about their election hopes. How much are you going to consider a candidate's attitude to technology when you vote?
It's been interesting to see how they haven't really dealt with technology that well. I mean, obviously the digital economy bill and what happened, that the awful farce of what took place, of the whole thing being debated over the space of 2 hours with no one in. I think it probably plays with me, more importantly, because I live and breathe technology all the time. I think it's probably important looking ahead and looking at the way that technology is effectively, completely and utterly shaping every element of our lives, from our social lives to our work. It's really important, and actually none of them have really come up and said anything that's really spoken to me in any interesting way, unlike the way that the obviously with the American presidential election, they dealt with technology, you know, very firmly and very interestingly in lots of different ways. And you really don't get the feeling that's happening with this election.
Well, we'll be talking more about the election in a special Tech Weekly next week with candidates from Labour, the Conservative Party, and the Liberal Democrats. Now, information on how to send in your questions for that program will be coming up later on in this week's Tech Weekly. In the meantime, stick around for the latest technology headlines and analysis over the next 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Here are the latest news stories from The Guardian. First, the social networking service Twitter used last week's Chirp conference as the platform to make some big announcements. They shared statistics about their users and outlined the details of the new promoted tweets facility. And they also announced At Anywhere, which allows people to tweet from wherever they are. Charles, what are the details on these things?
Well, Twitter gave out some very interesting statistics. Let's just start with those. 105 million registered users, possibly up to 106 by now, though that's not necessarily active users. 300,000 new users signing up every day, roughly 60% of those from outside the US. 180 million unique visitors per month, though it's not clear whether that's to Twitter.com, the website, or to the entire website, including the API, which is the sort of the round-the-back sort of access. Twitter's now got 175 people, up from 25 a year ago, and more than 100,000 Twitter applications, and 3 billion requests per day via the API. They talked about promoted tweets, which will initially start with when people do searches on Twitter. If it's searches like great coffee, then they'll have adverts from Starbucks posted at them. There's also people like Virgin Airlines and various others signed up.
Now, Keith, how, as a Twitter user, how do you think the promoted tweets will affect your experience of using the system?
From a gamer point of view, video game publishers are getting very into using Twitter. The forthcoming racing game Blur from Bizarre Creations up in Liverpool, you can actually Twitter out your high scores from the game to all your friends. So there's this real sense of obviously of social networking being kind of embraced by the technology. So I think the next obvious step is some form of advertising. And, you know, I'm sure people like EA and Activision will be looking at promoted tweets as a possibility of talking to gamers.
I'm not looking forward to that, to be honest. I like my Twitter unencumbered. I like getting my news. I like getting my links. I like being directed around the web from friends, from my social network, as opposed to from a sponsored ad. That almost feels a little bit dirty. I mean, Charles, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I use quite a few different Twitter applications. I use Twitterific, I use Tweety, and with those you can get free versions where ads appear in the feed. And, you know, if you don't want to look at the ad, don't look at the ad. If you don't want to click through the ad, don't click through the ad. But actually, sometimes the ads are relevant. Sometimes, you know, if they're well targeted enough and, you know, it's quite feasible using the sort of algorithms that are available to look at what people are getting in their feeds. And, you know, you would have thought to start to make it rather like Google does with searches in Gmail, where it targets ads to you, that ads could be targeted to you. So
what about something like the At Anywhere service? Can you explain a little bit about that? And for example, that might, and briefly, you know, how that might tie in with things like these targeted ads?
Well, At Anywhere is a way to, it's a bit like Facebook Connect. It's a way to let people connect to Twitter pretty much anywhere on the web, so that rather than having to say, oh, this is a really interesting page, then copy it and take it back to the Twitter page and enter it in, you would simply have a little box where you'd sign in directly and you'd be able to tweet it. It's a really interesting, very broad way of spreading Twitter everywhere.
And has The Guardian been involved with this in any way? Because I know that some of the coverage that we've had has mentioned, you know, some of the user guides to At Anywhere.
Well, Chris Thorpe, who's one of The Guardian's developers, has put an implementation in for politics coverage, which is live on The Guardian technology pages now. So go click around there and get a feeling of what it's like.
Brilliant. Well, also this week, two industry analysts released reports about year-on-year PC sales that painted a pretty rosy picture for this market. Charles, can you give us the headlines?
For the growth in PC shipments, they said that there was an unexpectedly high growth of 27.4%, according to Gartner, in the first quarter of 2010 to 84.3 million units sold. IDC says it was a 24% growth to 79 million units. Best growth since 2001. But of course, the thing is that this is all comparative. They're comparing to last year, which was a terrible year because of the financial crisis that had happened in 2008. So if you actually look at what had happened last year, the first quarter shipments, according to Gartner, were 67.2 million. So you're talking about 67.2 in a bad year, going up to 79.1 on a good one. But actually, comparatively, 2008, which was a better year, 300 million sold. You're talking about roughly a million a day. This is not quite back to that level. So they're really not actually doing that well.
Good. Well, I'm glad that we've got a good critical analysis of our statistics. Don't just believe the numbers, people. Look at it a little bit deeper.
Percentages, you know, these things where you sort of say, well, it's gone up by this many percent. You know, if you're comparing it to a bad year, well, yes, things often do. You've got to look at it in the longer term to see how these things are really moving.
So this suggests, though, that Windows 7 has not been a motivator for people to go out and get PCs?
Well, what you tend to see is that about three-fifths of PCs are bought by businesses and two-fifths are bought by consumers. So Windows 7 has been quite well received by consumers. People like it. But businesses haven't quite heaved themselves out of recession when it comes to buying computers. So I think that until you see businesses all starting to move to Windows 7, you're not going to see the real bump up in PC sales.
Well, finally, the web was buzzing last week when an iPhone 4, the next generation of the mobile handset after the current 3GS model, was accidentally left in a pub in Northern California. Come to my pub, please. As the images flew around the world across technology blogs, pundits began to realize that this wasn't a ruse, it wasn't a rumor, but that this was the genuine article. Charles, what's the story?
Well, a lot of deconstruction needs to be done here. First of all, it does seem to have been an Apple person did leave this prototype in a bar. Although it's not clear whether it was one of these lost things or whether it somehow was encouraged to leave their possession. And the person who then came to be handling it, it's claimed they reported it to Apple, that Apple didn't take very much notice of it. But they then sold it to Gizmodo for $5,000. Now, my reading of this, my reading of this kind of California Civil Code and the California Penal Code suggests that the person who sold it and Gizmodo as buyers of it are handlers of stolen goods, respectively. And at the time when we're recording, it's not clear whether Apple is going to go further than the straightforward legal letter it's written to Gizmodo. But if they wanted to, they could actually get criminal proceedings started here. The phone itself, pretty interesting because it's got a front-facing camera. It's got much more. It's got double the resolution in the graphics. And there's also a suggestion that it's got a ceramic casing, which would be tougher than glass and also would be, like glass, transparent to radio. So Apple would get the benefit there of something which would be able to operate at lower power. There you get longer battery life.
Well, you can read up on these stories and the latest technology news from around the web at guardian.co.uk/technology. The political machine is in full tilt, and next week we'll be grilling representatives from the three main parties about their plans for broadband, piracy and file sharing, rights and copyright, the Digital Economy Act, digital radio, and more. So you can send your questions for Stephen Timms, Labour MP for East Ham and Financial Secretary to the Treasury and Minister for Digital Britain, to Jeremy Hunt, Conservative MP for South West Surrey and Shadow Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport, and for Lord Ratzel, Liberal Democrat spokesperson for Business, Enterprise and Regulatory Reform. Now, there are several ways you can contribute to this extremely exciting program. Leave a comment on guardian.co.uk/technology or on our Facebook page. You can also tweet your questions to us at @GuardianTW, but please do add the hashtag #TechVote. Audioboo is a question of about 30 to 40 seconds, but do remember to introduce yourself and do have a listen back to your question to make sure that we can hear what you're saying in the recording. And also remember to tag this with #TechVote2. All the links are at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Now, one of the bigger questions that's already dominated the election campaign this year is MPs' expenses. A record number of seats are up for grabs because so many elected officials have chosen to hide under the parapet rather than be dragged over the political coals for misuses of allowable expenses.
Order, order. Since I came to this House 30 years ago, I've always felt that the House is at its best when it is united. In order that unity can be maintained, I have decided that I will relinquish the office of Speaker on Sunday, 21st of June. That is all I have to say on this matter. Order.
Speaker of the House of Commons, Michael Martin, resigning last year following the expenses scandal. Now, the woman who tirelessly pursued the story and broke it to the media was Freedom of Information Act campaigner and investigative journalist Heather Brook. I spoke with Heather on the phone last week and began by asking her what she thought had been the successes of the Freedom of Information Act.
Well, I think one of the first successes was that when the law was passed, there's a requirement that all the public bodies have to kind of do an audit of themselves, of their kind of organization and the different types of information they hold. And it was the first time that we really got a whole definitive list of all the public bodies in Britain. And there are thousands of them, I mean, tens of thousands of them. So that was the first big success, was knowing exactly how big the state apparatus was in the country. And then the second one is the kind of shifting of culture, that there's now an onus on officials that if they want to keep something secret, they have to provide a reason. In the past, it was always the person asking for information had to provide the reason, and now that's changed.
Speaking now more generally about transparency, where does the UK stand in, if you could create a worldwide league table, as it were, of the most to the least transparent country?
What passes for transparency in Britain would serve any secret society very well, because it is just incredibly secret. I mean, it's like a paranoia about the public knowing anything about really innocuous things, about the names of council officials, about restaurant inspections. I mean, I just can't believe that restaurant inspections are not just generally available to the public.
People criticize countries like China, Iran, various countries that hold information, that try and control information, that there's a level of state control of information in these countries. In your experience in observing and investigating this issue, would you say that the UK is any different?
I think it's less different than we'd like to think. So as far as like the controlling of information, I tell the story about these activists who later on became My Society, but before that they were just computer programmers, and they were trying to get access to the parliamentary record, which is Hansard, and they asked for it, you know, politely. They didn't get access to it, and they ended up scraping it off the web. And the parliamentary officials just couldn't stand this, because what they thought they had a right to control the way that information was presented. I mean, absolutely micromanage it, and that nobody had a right to come in and take official information and use it in different ways. So they had this huge battle to try, you know, these computer programmers to try and get this, what is supposed to be public data, and make it searchable so that citizens could see how MPs voted and when their MPs had attended debates, etc. So that to me is an example that things are not quite as open as we'd like to think they are.
How much do you think that the government comprehends, and I mean really comprehends, understands the power of the information that they've collected, the vast quantities of information that they've collected, and also, to that end, the technologies that they're using to collect them?
I don't think they've got any clue. I think most of the people in government right now are incredibly ignorant about technology, Luddites, in fact, I would say. And they just, it reminds me of like, a bit like the Antiques Roadshow. If you've got somebody who sort of has an attic full of stuff, and now they kind of realize, oh, I've watched the Antiques Roadshow, and some of this could be really valuable. So they sort of think that now they want to just charge the public these usurious rates for information the public has already paid for through their taxes. And so now you've got sort of the worst of both worlds, where you've got technically ignorant public officials who have kind of wised up to the point where they understand that this information is useful and valuable. But instead of also understanding there's a public service remit to make that available to the public who paid for it initially, that also they make more money in the long term if they just release it, because that encourages innovation.
There is no transparency about all of the various fields of data that are collected on us, are there?
No, I mean, there's nowhere a sort of a list of all the surveillance databases or personal information databases that the state collects. And even people in the state don't have any idea, you know, they just keep collecting them. And it's as if for every social ill, there is a database, and that is somehow the magic bullet that is going to save us from all social ills. That's something which I think is going to feature very heavily in the election, is this attitude about technology. Is it right that we spend so much of our budget on creating databases when there isn't any evidence that they're actually solving these social problems that they were put there initially to solve? So we need to sort of rethink, are these an effective use of money? Should our money be spent somewhere else? Are there other more effective ways to solve crime, to deal with social care problems, etc.?
I'm thrilled that technology is such an important election issue.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the potential dangers in terms of surveillance, transparency, freedom of information, and these things that you discuss of the Digital Britain paper.
I think the big problem with that paper and with the way it was passed is that you've got a bill which is very, you know, it's dealing with a whole new economy, which is being debated by people who have like no clue, absolutely no clue about what technology is. Most of them are just arts graduates and seemingly not the brightest ones at that. So you need this bill to be debated by people with some level of technical expertise. And those people, sadly, are just not in Parliament. As we had the Industrial Revolution, this is sort of the information revolution, and yet our public services are very much behind the times and haven't really caught up with the fact that this is the new economy and they need to educate themselves about how it works.
Are there other elements, are there other regulations that were outlined that would have thwarted your pursuit of MPs' expenses, do you think?
This emphasis on copyright and the idea that you can copyright public information is very insidious, because that's just another form of censorship. And that's how people need to start thinking about copyright. I mean, it's all very well to say we need to provide people with a living, but copyright has moved vastly away from that, and now what it's being used for is just either usurious greed or anti-competitive practices or censorship. And it strikes me that copyright in that Digital Economy Bill Act is a lot to do with stopping people from using information for the betterment of society as a whole.
In addition, there's also the surveillance element of it, isn't there? There's the potential for ISPs to track your behavior online, and then ultimately to then be beholden to government. So there's that element as well.
Yeah, and I mean, we already have this Internet Watch Foundation, a very shadowy organization which even I don't really know that much about, which is a charity. And in Britain, it has a blacklist of websites, which we don't know, because they're kept secret, what exactly they are. And that's just a blacklist. So, you know, it's websites which are taken offline and you can't access. And in Australia, where they have a similar system, that list was leaked onto WikiLeaks. And it turned out it wasn't just sort of what we might expect, child abuse websites. It was all kinds of things, including WikiLeaks itself, and sort of random stuff like bus companies and other websites which said things the government wasn't really keen on. So we do already have some level of internet surveillance going on in Britain, and it strikes me that this new law is just going in the opposite direction, making it a bit worse.
Heather Brooke. You can read more of that interview at observer.co.uk/review. As we mentioned, next week we're speaking with the main political parties about their plans for the UK's technology strategy. But the political analysts predict that there will be more independent MPs taking seats in Parliament when this year's election results are in. There are several independent hopefuls who believe that technology is so important that it should be at the centre of their platform promises. Two are here today. Denny De La Haye is standing in Hackney South as GetAVote.org on a platform of direct digital democracy, giving people a voice in politics through online tools. Andrew Robinson, down the line, is the leader of Pirate Party UK, a political action group who rose to fame when several of their representatives were elected to office in Sweden recently. Andrew is standing as a prospective parliamentary candidate for Worcester and seeks to influence technology policy. Welcome to you both. I'd like to come to you first, Denny. Can you tell me what direct digital democracy means?
The idea is that I want to share my vote with all the voters in my constituency. Obviously, to get that kind of mass interaction, the way you're going to do that is through the internet. The basic principle is for every vote that's coming up in Parliament, I'm going to put an online poll on a website and a discussion board around that issue. People can discuss the issue, they can read information, resources about the issue, and they can vote yes or no. And whichever way the majority comes out, that is how I will vote in Parliament.
Andrew, what does the Pirate Party UK stand for?
We've got a fairly tight manifesto, mainly concentrating on areas where the law is hopelessly out of date because of new technology, which basically covers copyright, patents, freedom of speech and privacy. And beyond that, our candidates are all individually allowed to follow their own mind and listen to their own constituents, which is a big strong point for us. Copyright law is increasingly becoming important in our everybody's daily lives. The government is saying there are 7 million file sharers, and it's trying to change what those file sharers do and stop them doing what they want to do on the internet. So this is an issue that affects at least 10% of the population, judging by that method. Plus, they're actually planning to cut off internet connections to whole families because one person is actually infringing on copyright, which means this could affect up to 3/4 of the population, to be honest.
Denny, you're looking more at using technology for the process, to reform the process of the parliamentary system. But what about things like finance and health? I mean, surely these are more important issues for the general public rather than trying to completely turn the system on its head.
I don't think you can address individual issues anymore until you fix the failings of the current political system. Our system's called representative democracy. But as we've seen increasingly over the last few years, over the last 15 years even, our representatives aren't representing us anymore. So that's what I'm trying to address first.
Doesn't the problem then become one of, well, why would you have MPs? Why not then just set it up so that, you know, at a particular time, everyone just lines up in front of their computer or with their mobile phone, and you say, okay, everyone, you know, vote now. And pretty rapidly you'd have, you know, if there was enough of a sort of groundswell about it, you'd have a return on capital punishment, you'd have abortion being outlawed, you know, all sorts of things that you might want in a sort of liberal with a small L democracy like the UK. You might say, actually, no, let's think about this a bit.
The death penalty is a popular one that people bring up. The last couple of opinion polls on it have been under 50%. We've been becoming more liberal on that one over the years. But in general, yeah, I'm actually in favour of cutting MPs out of the equation. I think maybe we should have an elected second house and cut the first house out, make it a directly representative
system. But don't you then get the problem that, you know, rather with general elections, you don't get everyone voting. You only get the people who are very interested in voting who do it. And they're going to be the ones who are most motivated, but not necessarily the ones whose views reflect the views of the wider population. Rather like in California, where Proposition 8 passed, where it wasn't clear that it actually reflected the wider views of the population of California.
It passed very narrowly, as I understand it, and you can take the same argument there for the recent referendum on minarets in Switzerland, who do have a kind of direct democracy system based on referendums. And occasionally you will get a vote that just slides over to the side that you disagree with, but that's the way the vote has come out, and that's a direct democracy. The fact that these votes generate so much controversy and so much media attention suggests to me that they're unusual.
Andrew, I'd like to jump over to you and talk a little bit about the central issues that you feel the MPs should know about. Recently, the Digital Economy Act has been hotly contested, and in fact, a lot of people have been quite upset that it was passed with such a short period of time in discussion. Is this one of the central digital issues that you feel MPs should know about? What are some of these things that you feel that you would like to bring to the House?
Well, it's very important that we actually have a proper discussion on these issues. The real problem with the Digital Economy Act is that it's jumped straight to how do we stop file sharing. They've missed out all the stages of the process, which are, should we stop file sharing? Is it actually beneficial to the economy? And the next stage is, if we stop file sharing, how much of our civil rights do we have to give up in order to do that?
Is that really what the Act is saying? I don't think it is. It's saying, should we stop illicit piracy of, you know, the illicit use of products which other people own in the evanescent digital sense by people who haven't been given explicit permission to use them in that way? That's what it's about, surely.
Indeed, and it's this whole issue of explicit permission. The basic idea of copyright is to encourage people to write more useful books, is what the original Act said 300 years ago.
But I'm not sure it is. Surely what the Copyright Act is about is saying, this person has produced this thing, they get a certain amount of protection for it in reward for letting us see it.
Indeed, and it's how much that certain amount of protection should be that the part of the debate that just hasn't happened. Nobody's actually looked at copyright and said, is there too much of it, too little of it? Is it too restrictive, not restrictive enough? And we need to have that debate before we start moving on to how we punish people who go beyond what's really good for society.
But Andrew Gower's led a review of copyright a couple of years ago, which broadly came down in keeping it how it is.
But he didn't make any real investigation into the economic impacts and the benefits to society of having more things in the public domain and reducing the length of copyright.
Andrew, how would you make your fellow elected officials aware of these issues? Would you go down a public participation route, a direct digital democracy route, like Denny is proposing, or how would you bring up these things so that people become aware of the importance?
Well, this is the big problem for us. Copyright is a very complicated issue, as are drug patents, which are another part of a similar sort of thing that needs a lot more thought and discussion. And I think the only way to really solve the problem that we saw in the Digital Economy Act, which is that they only had 2 hours to discuss things and very, very few MPs actually bothered turning up to the debate. They just block voted at the end. The only way to fix this problem is for the general public to say, look, this costs you votes. So I'm really here saying if you're angry about the Digital Economy Act, If you saw how badly it was rammed through Parliament, how little discussion there was, then you've got to show your MPs at the ballot box that this is hurting them. They need to do their jobs properly.
Danny, how would you say that technology has changed our relationship with elected officials? I mean, this is an example, isn't it? The Digital Economy Act was a very hot topic on social media like Twitter and Facebook and various other places. But we're not actually seeing any real effects on the inside of the political machine.
Absolutely. And I couldn't have asked for a better demonstration of the reason I'm running on a political reform platform than having the Digital Economy Bill go shooting through the Lords and Parliament in the way that it did. I mean, it happened in parallel with my election campaign, and it's a fantastic demonstration of why the system does need fixing. Keith said something earlier about technology now affects every aspect of our lives. I think so does politics. And again, it's one of those insidious things people don't really realise until something dramatic happens that personally affects them. That's kind of the reason that I'm trying to re-engage people in politics on a per-issue basis, so where they can see that politics affects something that they care about, that's when I want them to get involved and vote on that issue. And I think that will bring more people into politics than the opportunity to pick a representative once every 4 years does.
Andrew, finally, briefly, what do you see as the benefits of being an independent member of Parliament when you've got a tranche of people who perhaps aren't as engaged as you are on a particular issue?
Well, the great thing is that you can actually, by not having a party whip, you can actually represent people. I was speaking to a lot of people in the constituency who are very disappointed that the Labour MP voted in certain ways, even though that Labour MP has made a few statements saying that he was against the general principles. And it's the party whip that's the problem. It stops MPs representing people. And an independent or someone from a small party with a small manifesto like the Pirate Party is free from all that. They can actually represent people, which our MPs just can't do at the moment.
And Denny, also very briefly, how do you feel technology has changed our relationship with the political machine, not just with our elected officials?
I have a lot of people on my Twitter stream who are politically engaged, but they're all politically engaging with each other. I'm not convinced the system yet has reached out to pull in people who are interested in an issue, but don't think about it as a political issue. And I think that's where we need to go next.
Thanks very much to Denny de la Haye and Andrew Robinson. You can find out their policies and their manifestos online, of course, at getavote.org and pirateparty.org.uk. The hotly anticipated new video game Alan Wake will be released for the Xbox 360 next month. Modeled on Twin Peaks and the X-Files, experts believe that it will usher in a whole new way to tell stories.
In order to create the game's unique action, Remedy's goal was to integrate the themes of light and darkness into the combat. The dark presence that threatens Wake is possessing the local townsfolk, and Wake's shadowy enemies seem invincible under the cover of darkness. Before the player can fight them, he first needs to burn away the darkness with light.
Alan Wake for the Xbox 360. Now, Keith Stewart met with Oz Hakkinen, head of franchise development for Remedy Games. Keith, tell us what's interesting about Alan Wake.
Well, I think there's maybe two key things that are interesting about the game. One is that it's by this company, Remedy Entertainment, who's based in Finland, and there's only 45 of them in the studio. If you think about most AAA game developments these days, if you look at something like Ubisoft, they'll have something like 200 people on the development team. So it's a tiny development team, and they've worked on this game for 5 years. So it's a real labour of love for them, which it's incredible to find a publisher that actually indulge a developer like that. So that's interesting. The other thing that's interesting about it is they've taken all of their references, really their inspiration from TV series, and I think this kind of really marks a turning point for games in general. So that was really what I wanted to ask Oz about. So I sort of ran it in and said, you know, what's the background to the story of this game?
After the Max Payne series, we were in a fortunate position to kind of take our time prototyping different types of ideas, and we came up with the concepts of light and dark, of how we can utilize that within the story perspective, but also as a gameplay mechanic. And, you know, the kind of themes of the light and darkness are deeply kind of interwoven into the story. Alice is afraid of the dark, and she's explained to Alan Wake, you know, what it feels like to be afraid of the dark. And you know, Wake tries to understand, but he says in the end that he doesn't really understand what it feels like. But every player that plays Alan Wake at one point will know what it feels like to be afraid of the dark. Wake's enemies, they're covered in these shadows and protected by the dark presence, and you need some kind of light source to first burn away that dark presence before they're vulnerable to the conventional weapons. We have different types of flashlights, we have flashbang grenades, we have hand flares, we have flare guns. You know, you can use light turrets, you can even use the street lamps as a source of protection. So that's kind of a eerie thing when you're running out of, for instance, some kind of light source and you have to run to a street lamp for safety. You're scared because of your own inhibitions and your own fears, rather than something that we're making you be scared of.
How do you keep a team motivated for 5 years?
You know, this has been a labour of love, and you know, we're a small team of about 45 people, and it's just been a process for us. I mean, you know, everybody has been on board with the concept and what we wanted to kind of achieve with Alan Wake, and you know, we knew that we wanted to gain that level of authenticity before we could add that layer of the supernatural there. So we did a hell of a lot of research. We were out in the Pacific Northwest, traveling over 3,000 miles, taking over 60,000 research photos, having people even, you know, record the ambient sounds of the kind of soundscape in the woods in the Pacific Northwest. And, you know, there's a level of authenticity there that everybody can be proud of. And this doesn't sum it up necessarily, but if you look up to the sky in Alan Wake, the constellation of stars are accurate to that of the Pacific Northwest. So, you know, the team have been, you know, super motivated because it's been a long development, but at the same time it's been something that, you know, each and every one of us have been proud of to kind of contribute to get a Remedy's masterpiece, if you like.
Can you tell us a little bit about what Alan Wake's about? Because a lot of our readers might not know the kind of the background of the story.
Alan Wake, he's a best-selling writer. But the guy hasn't written anything for a while, for a couple of years now. He had a successful line of crime novels about a New York, a hard-boiled New York detective. And after that, he hadn't written anything for a couple of years. And that brought problems in his life with his marriage and with his work. His agent was pressuring him. The paparazzi was pressuring him. The fans were pressuring him for his next book, and in a kind of last hope to gain back his creative flow, his wife Alice takes him away to the beautiful setting of the Pacific Northwest to a small town called Bright Falls. But shortly upon arrival there, she goes missing without a trace. Now, worst of all, after she disappears, his latest work, a thriller novel that he doesn't even remember writing, starts coming true before his very eyes, word for word. So, I mean, from a very high level, this is a psychological action thriller. It's a story-driven experience. Every time Wake finds a manuscript page, it comes true. And when the player finds the manuscript page, he knows it's going to come true. He just doesn't know where, when, or how.
Obviously, Remedy's very famous for the Max Payne games. How has the video game way of dealing with story changed since Max Payne? How have you kind of evolved it for Alan Wake?
Back in the Max Payne days, I mean, we definitely were pushing the envelope in storytelling in video games, and we wanted to even go further with Alan Wake. So, you know, choosing a writer as the lead character gave us extra tools of doing that. So a writer is a natural storyteller, and choosing a writer, we kind of added that inner monologue. So what we wanted to kind of get away from, and which a lot of video games do, is that you have gameplay and then the only way of telling the story is cutscene. So you go cutscene, gameplay, cutscene, gameplay, and often during that gameplay sequences you forget what the story is, and then you're reminded by the cutscene. So we wanted to have a progressive lead up to the cutscenes, that the cutscenes were more like a layer to the story rather than the only way of delivering the story.
Oskari Hakkinen, or Oz Hakkinen, from Remedy Games. Now, Keith, how is the narrative approach to this game different from previous games?
I think the key thing, really, with this game is that it's at the forefront, really, of a new trend in game development, in that it's taken its influences much more from TV narrative styles than cinematic styles. I mean, up until 3 or 4 years ago, everyone was being influenced by cinema, by the cinematic structure. But Alan Wake and also Heavy Rain, which came out earlier this year, are really sort of structured around a sort of a almost very similar to the big kind of box set TV series like, you know, Mad Men and Lost. They work much more in that way. So you get a much kind of richer, fuller story experience.
Does taking its cues from TV really make a difference from taking its cues from cinema?
I think so, yeah. I mean, if you think about it, you know, films are 2 hours long. They have a three-act structure and usually set very heavily centred around a central one central protagonist, which is what games were like. But if you look at things like Alan Wake, I mean, obviously Alan Wake has a very strong protagonist at its centre, but it's also got a very, very rich selection of characters involved in it. It's very similar to sort of Twin Peaks in that it has these little kind of cameo roles in it. And there's also multiple stories which you will get in something like Mad Men that you wouldn't get in a movie because there just isn't time. And if you think about it, it makes sense because a video game experience like Alan Wake is about 20 hours. Well, that's roughly similar to a TV series and, you know, and a film is only 2 hours. So it gives you a kind of a broader canvas, really, to talk about characterization and to develop plots that games weren't really doing a few years ago, but now games like Alan Wake and Heavy Rain and the forthcoming L.A. Noire game from Rockstar are going to do more of.
And, of course, this is really emphasizing the role of the writer, which is something I know that had started to boil up in the games development industry, but is this really the realization of that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, whenever Remedy are doing press, it's usually the writer of the game, Sam Lake, that's involved. In fact, Sam Lake's going to be at the Screenlit Festival in Nottingham talking about the game. And he's really been kind of being pushed forward as the sort of the major spokesperson, whereas in the past it would be maybe a game designer, it might be a coder. And again, this is much more similar to television than it is with film. In film, it's the director that usually kind of takes center stage. But in television, it's usually the creator, the writer, you know, with people like Alan Ball, who did 6 Feet Under. They're the ones that sort of get the fame in a way, and that's maybe where games are going too. So it's much more about writing.
I have a problem with this whole idea that games are becoming more like TV. Games are unique. They're interactive. They're playthings. They're things that you do. They're not things that just wash over you. So, I mean, surely trying to make a game more like a TV series or even, you know, more like a cinematic experience is just completely ruining the point of what is unique and beautiful about games.
You're very passionate about this, Alex.
I'm very passionate. You can see my face is getting
yeah,
red.
And she's shaking. She's going to grab me around the throat.
How dare you bring this to my attention?
I'm being attacked.
Is this a step forward or is this a step back for games?
I think games designers have to be very, very careful. I completely understand your point. The last thing I want to do is go back to the era of, I don't know, when CD-ROM first came out, you got all these awful interactive movies coming out. But that's not what's happening here. What games designers like Remedy are doing is using the tropes, the recognisable tropes of the way that TV tells stories and bringing that into an interactive environment. One of the really interesting things that Heavy Rain did, it really made you feel like a virtual actor. It made you feel as if, by interacting with these characters, you were telling a story that almost directing a story for yourself through interaction. So interacting is the central component, but it's using techniques from television in terms of deeper characterization for the sort of outlying characters, multiple plot threads. That's not bad. That's not infringing on interaction. What it's doing is adding kind of depth to the experience, but it's got to be well used. It's got to be well implemented.
Well, if this has whetted your appetite and you want to know more, as Keith said, there's an onstage Q&A session with Sam Lake, the writer of Alan Wake, on the 24th of April. Sam will be at the Broadway Cinema in Nottingham answering questions from the audience. Links are on the Games blog. Thanks to our guests, Denny DeLahaye and Andrew Robinson, and to our in-house team, Charles Arthur and Keith Stewart. The producer was Scott Cawley. Next week, the podcast will be available to download a little later than usual on Thursday. It's the election special with Jeremy Hunt, Stephen Timms, and Lord Russell. Send us your questions on the blog, tweet with the hashtag TechVote, and we'll use the best. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Alex Kratosky. See you next Thursday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.